the Biden administration is being criticized for its backing of Israel. Last week, US planes airdropped thousands of humanitarian food packages into Gaza. And Vice President Kamala Harris has called for a ceasefire before Ramadan. More than 150 days since Hamas's murderous attack of October 7th, how should we evaluate US policy toward this conflict? Welcome to New Idea Live, the podcast of the Ayn Rand Institute. My name is Zimowit Gowen, and with me today is Ilan Jurno. Hi, Ilan.
Hi, Zimowit.
So let me start by asking you a question that is, I think, very important and is, I don't think that it's an easy question. First of all, do you think whether America should be supporting Israel, and if so, why?
I do think they should, and I think it's a simpler question than most people realize once you put it in the right moral framework. I think the essential issue is to evaluate the two sides by the principle of freedom. The two sides are Israel and the Hamas regime in Gaza. Israel is a basically free country. It has freedom of speech, protects property, it protects the freedom of individuals to live their lives and build and produce and innovate. It is the same kind of country morally as the United Kingdom or France or Denmark. On the other side of this conflict is Hamas, which is it exists in order to destroy Israel precisely because Israel is a free society. Hamas, and this is a part of the way people think about this issue that is really corrupt. Hamas is an ideological movement. It's part of the Islamic totalitarian movement. It is driven by this vision of dominating people's lives in the name of religious Islamic law. That's its reason for existing. It wants to destroy freedom in Israel, to destroy freedom within its own dominion. When you see a conflict that is as clear-cut as this one, I think it is, you can't be neutral. And you certainly can't pretend that there's a gray zone here. There isn't. This is a night and day moral difference. This is a point I've been arguing since before October 7th. This is a point I argue in my book, What Justice Demands. This is a clear-cut moral issue. And I think that the essential reason for America to have an interest in this is that Israel's enemy is our enemy too. We were faced by the Islamic totalitarian movement on 9/11 and since then and before then. And the region is dominated by regimes that are supportive of this ideology and by groups that are supportive of this ideology. The Taliban, Al-Qaeda, which people now have forgotten, Islamic State, they're all part of the same ideological movement. Now, they fight among themselves and they hate each other, but they are basically all hostile to the values that Israel embodies to a significant degree and that America embodies to a significant degree. The ideal of a government that protects individual rights. So we have common values at stake and we have the same enemies at stake. And I think it's a matter of justice when you understand it that way, that you support the good and you oppose the evil. In this case, I think Hamas is so clearly on the side of evil.
So the second question I wanted to ask you is, there's a prevalent view that you find everywhere in people's comments, when you listen to experts, when you listen to other politicians, that basically America supports Israel very often blindly. And you know, there's some evidence for that, like vetoing an UN resolution, or President Biden himself said that the US support for Israel is, quote, rock solid and unwavering. So is it really true that America is supporting Israel? And if not, what is it really doing?
I think America's support for Israel could be characterized as schizophrenic, or you could characterize it as driven by a fundamental conflict over what is right and what is proper to do versus what is so-called practical. The essential problem is that the United States does not approach this issue from a principled perspective. It approaches it from a kind of unthinking support of Israel on the one hand. So it gives it some military aid, and there's some understanding of why you would do that. It lets Israel buy weapons and technology. And I think that's the right thing to do, but it isn't framed in a proper moral context. And you can see that because when Israel needs to use these weapons. The response from the United States is, here are the weapons, don't dare use them. And that is not true support. True support requires understanding that the point of having weapons is to defend yourself. And that if you have the right to defend yourself against an enemy, you need to be able to act on it. And that's the part that you might describe as schizophrenic, which is the United States provides Israel with significant military aid and intelligence and a lot of rhetoric in support of its position, but then it withholds what I think is an underappreciated aspect, which is the moral support, the moral endorsement that Israel is in the right to defend itself. It has a moral claim to support to defend its own people from this nihilistic regime in Gaza and in the West Bank. So this division between giving Israel military aid and then withholding the moral support, I think that's the problem that people don't appreciate. And I'm amused and disgusted when I hear people say that the US is overly supportive, because my view is, what's the point of giving Israel all this weaponry and all this rhetoric when in fact the chorus for the United States, and this is true under Biden, it was true under previous administrations when Israel faced attacks from Hamas and from Hezbollah and from other places, the refrain is, hold back, restrain yourself, do not fight to win, do not fight to defeat your enemies, do not fight to end this war conclusively. And we're seeing it now in Gaza since October 7th. The US has been relentless in insisting on that Israel hold back, delay, create so-called humanitarian corridors, provide humanitarian relief. All of these are negating Israel's right to defend itself, which I don't think the United States would tolerate in any other context with respect to its own citizens and its responsibility to protect them. This is a moral inversion. It's separating out what is good and what is practical. And this comes from, I think it comes from a widely held moral view that is shaping and influencing American policy, which is, it's really undercutting. And I think of this as the great moral inversion. You can see it in the moments right after October 7th. There was a moment, maybe a day or so, when many people healthily reacted and said, yes, Israel has to defend itself, has to retaliate against this barbarism. But that faded. And it's now, we notice when you see news reports and coverage about this, the reality of what Hamas did is now well in the background. It's as if it's a footnote, it's a passing comment, it's something, it's a box that you check when you talk about this. It doesn't have the same reality, and it certainly doesn't have the moral reality that it needs to have in the way people think about this issue. So it's now in the background. And what is now in the foreground is Israel's retaliation. And that is seen as morally suspect, at least, if not worse. And this is coloring the US approach, because even as the US is giving military and material support, it's withholding what I think of as the most significant kind of support, which is the moral endorsement that it's right to retaliate against this enemy. And this is an inversion, because morally, who's responsible for the war? It's Hamas, as the initiator of the conflict, as the one that attacked on October 7th and attacked previously as well. What happens under this conventional moral view is that the moral responsibility is dropped out of the context. It's ignored, it's evaded, it's pushed aside. And what is dominant in people's thinking is the visceral emotional reaction to suffering, because this moral idea, which Ayn Rand calls it altruism, it's the idea that morality is about negation of success, negation of value, sacrificing. What that teaches is a focus on suffering, lack of value, misery. And when people see that, and it's real, there's certainly significant suffering in Gaza, that overwhelms their ability to think about the issue morally. And they now are focused on how Israel is making things worse for the Palestinians. That is a complete inversion. The real question here, the real issue is, why isn't there no comparable, or why is there no outrage at the fact that Hamas created this crisis, this war, and that all the suffering that is seen in Gaza right now, that is entirely Hamas's responsibility. And we don't see that because this is the influence of the moral idea of altruism. And some of the evidence for this, right? So some of the evidence for this is not only is Israel pressured to allow aid convoys into Gaza. Just think about that for a moment. It's a war zone, and yet it's supposed to provide aid. It has to support a essentially hostile population. The aid goes, some of it undoubtedly goes to Hamas. That is an essentially sacrificial position. So the issue now is not whether Israel should supply these, allow these convoys in. It's how dare Israel inspect these convoy trucks? How dare it limit the number of trucks? Why isn't it providing more trucks? And notice the inversion here. Why is that the focus versus the evil of Hamas for creating this crisis and for exploiting all the people above ground and not in the tunnels? That is a really crucial moral inversion. There's a lot more to say about this in the way it affects US policy. And it might be useful to talk a bit about the airdrops as well, if you're interested in that.
Yeah, so before we talk about the airdrops, I wonder, so you have characterized US policy as schizophrenic, and I think that's a correct view. How do you see the rest of the world and other countries or institutions? What is their, in your view, approach to this war?
I think it's colored by some of the same ideas. It's colored by this altruistic idea. Notice that, think about the convoy massacre, so-called, from about a week ago, where people were coming in Gaza to get aid from a truck that was delivering food, and there was a stampede, the people shot, and there's a lot of chaos. The responses to that are really telling. Now, there are certain questions about fact and what happened and what actually went down in the scene. But the responses suggest that the questions about fact and responsibility are not the questions people are asking. I think this is telling. What is at the forefront is how dare Israel have military on the ground and try to defend its soldiers if they feel threatened, and for creating anarchy and lawlessness such that aid can't be delivered properly. Why is that the responsibility of Israel? Why is it not understood, which I think it is, as Hamas's responsibility? Hamas is the government. Even if its people, its leaders are underground or in other locations, it is responsible for the chaos, the lawlessness, the anarchy, the famine, if there is one, and the suffering in Gaza. And yet it's completely flipped. The question that people are looking at is the wrong question. The responsibility that they're ascribing is inverted. So I think that's another example of how the focus is on why isn't Israel doing more to alleviate the suffering in Gaza? That's the wrong question. The right issue here is the evil of Hamas. So the right issue here to talk about is the evil of Hamas for creating this crisis and for putting these people in this position, not for Israel allowing trucks in and enforcing some stringent protection of its interests to the extent that it's doing that in what it allows in. So convoy trucks have been going into Gaza for more than a decade because of the blockade. And we know that a lot of the things that have been allowed in were used to arm Hamas and help them create the tunnels that they've been using. So it's entirely reasonable. But then if you step back and say, why is there even an aid convoy going in? That to me is really the wrong decision, but it's taken for granted. And then the criticism is it's not Israel's not doing enough. It's allowing too few of these trucks. And that's sort of the wider perspective on this. Notice how little is said about Hamas's responsibility and how much unfounded responsibility, moral responsibility, is ascribed to Israel. So Israel is continually presented as the one that's culpable for all the suffering. And in reality, it's the one that's defending itself. It's trying to eliminate a threat to its own people and to the people of Gaza. That is a moral inversion. You can't explain that exclusively by political factors or considerations. I think it's ultimately a moral distortion that comes from this prevailing view of altruism. I wanted to say something about the airdrops because it's really maddening. And this, I think, is partly the reflection of altruism in US response to this conflict and pressure from the outside world on the US. So this is two ways in which altruism is operating, both within the US and from the rest of the world against the US. So one is some of our viewers might be old enough to remember or might have read about the US approach to the Afghanistan war. And in the first weeks of the war, the US approach was revealed to be, I think, the wrong kind of approach. It was self-defeating and self-crippled, precisely in the same way of being self-sacrificial. So the war began, as you might have expected, for good reason, which was to defeat and eliminate the vestiges of the Taliban regime that was hosting Al-Qaeda, which was responsible for 9/11. But within weeks, there were airdrops of food. And this was on the premise that it's America's responsibility to alleviate the suffering of people in Afghanistan. And that is not true. That is an inversion. The responsibility is that of the regime that was in power and the people that it was harboring. It is tragic the people in Afghanistan had to suffer because of that if they were not responsible, not supportive of that regime. That's a question, how many of them were. But that was the hallmark of the American approach that unfolded in Afghanistan. This is something I've written about in a couple of books that people can look at. One is Winning the Unwinnable War, and the other is Failing to Confront Islamic Totalitarianism. So the US did airdrops of humanitarian aid, so-called humanitarian aid, into Afghanistan. Where did it go? Some of it went to people who are hungry, maybe. A lot of it went to the people we were trying to defeat. So this is literally a case of enabling your own enemy. That was Afghanistan. And when I saw the airdrops into Gaza, I had a really powerful reaction because it reminded me exactly of what happened in Afghanistan. And in some ways it's worse, because in some ways it's worse, some ways it isn't. But the main way in which I think it's worse is that in Afghanistan, you could make the argument more credibly that fewer people in Afghanistan were culpable or at all responsible morally for being supportive of the regime that was in power and that was our enemy at the time. Because Afghanistan was a broken country. It wasn't clear how much centralized knowledge there was about what the regime was doing. But I'm not saying that's true. I'm saying it's more credible. You can make that case. The situation with Gaza is different in that we know there are many people in Gaza who support Hamas. They supported Hamas when there was an election. They allow Hamas to build tunnel entrances into their homes. There are many people who are supportive of the building of those tunnels. Now, the tunnel network in Gaza is revealing in this respect, which is, you can't build a tunnel network that vast with three guys and a pickup. It takes a lot of people to contribute their labor to build that kind of, and that suggests that there's a significant number of people in the population who are at least going along with Hamas, if not actively supporting its campaign against a free society. So there's less credibility that there are that many people in Gaza who are truly innocent. Now, I think there are. I think many of the children are, and they're not responsible for what their parents have put them into. But for adults, I think it's much less credible. And yet that is what's happening. The U.S. is dropping food aid on a population that is hostile both to Israel. Many of them are hostile to Israel. We know that. And many of them are hostile to the US. So you're in effect arming people or feeding people who are hostile to you. This is what Ayn Rand called the sanction of the victim. You're supporting your own attackers, your own destroyers. And that is a reflection of this morality of altruism. This is what it commands you to do. So that's the US behaving in a way that's shaped by this altruistic approach, which I think is detrimental to the US, and it's severely detrimental to Israel. Let me say one other thing about the airdrops. This speaks to the influence of altruistic thinking among leaders in other parts of the world, other countries, the so-called United Nations. And I say so-called because they're not united and many of them shouldn't be nations. And it's a corrupt organization in my view. The reaction to the US airdrops is really horrifying to me because the reaction is not as it should be. Why are you doing this? This is not supportive of your interests, not supportive of Israel's military campaign in self-defense. It's not supportive of any good goal. That's my reaction to it. What you actually see on the world stage is something vastly different. It's an inversion of that, which is the US is dropping aid, and in doing that, it's lifting the pressure on Israel to do more sacrificial convoys. So the criticism is, this isn't enough. Shielding Israel from its moral responsibility. Now, notice what's being dropped again. Notice how the context of the moral responsibility of Hamas is not even in the background anymore. It's just not present in the thinking. This is part of how the altruistic idea really corrupts one's ability to judge a situation objectively. So the criticism of the airdrops is, it's not enough, it can't feed enough people, and it's a distraction from what Israel needs to be doing, which is more convoys, more self-sacrificial aid that it is responsible for delivering. That to me is, it's hard to find something more absurd and more morally disgusting. And I think this is, if you want to pull the threads together and say, is the US supportive of Israel? In one aspect it is, it's providing military aid, but if its response to Israel is, don't you dare use it, hold back, restrain yourself, don't defeat Hamas essentially. And on top of it, you are responsible for supplying food to a hostile population, supplying electricity and water to this population. If those are the things that you're insisting Israel do and pressuring it to do, you can't seriously regard that as a supportive policy, because it's withholding the crucial moral endorsement of its moral right to self-defense, which is, I think, unquestionable here.
So I also wanted to ask you briefly about your view about ceasefires. So I've already mentioned Kamala Harris calling for a ceasefire. And I believe that yesterday or 2 days ago, President Biden said basically the same thing, that he hopes for a ceasefire before Ramadan. What's your reaction to that?
I think the same as many people's reaction about the concrete details of a ceasefire. There was a ceasefire in place on October 6th. So if you think a ceasefire is going to do any good, you're delusional. There was a ceasefire before Hamas's previous attack in 2021. There was a ceasefire before the previous attack in 2014 and 2012 and 2009, 2008, 2006. A ceasefire just means it's time for Hamas to regroup, rearm, and come back to the battlefield. So in that respect, I think it's delusional as a remedy. And I think the aspect of it that is under-recognized is the fact that there's a it drops out of the picture. What is the point of this war? What is the goal? What should be the goal? And is Israel pursuing it? And I think there's criticisms to make of Israel for not pursuing it properly and not really taking it seriously. But I think the proper response and the goal for this war is to defeat Hamas, to eliminate it, not just degrade its capability. And I think a ceasefire is a confession that that's not on the table. It's, we're going to just stop the fighting, let it regroup. And in fact, it's the farthest thing from humanitarian. If you really care about human life, what you should want to see is Hamas eliminated as fast as possible. And I'm horrified that we're at past day 150 and this war is still ongoing. I don't think it should be. It should have been ended long ago. So in that sense, the ceasefire is delusional. It is subverting the goal of what should be happening, which is to eliminate this hostile force. And I think the other aspect that's underappreciated or not recognized is there is this pressure now to get the ceasefire in place before Ramadan, which is the holy month in Islam. And again, this reminds me of what happened in the early days of the Afghanistan war, which again, there was a concern about Ramadan, there's a concern about holy places. And my reaction to that is not at all the right perspective. When the whole premise of Hamas's political vision is Islam must dominate as a totalitarian system. If that's what they're about, which is, this is in their charter, this is what they live for, this is the kind of society they have worked to build, and that is fundamentally hostile to human life. It's predicated on Islam as the dominant principle of society. And if you're saying, oh no, we have to respect Islam, we have to respect this religious time, let's hold a ceasefire, what is that except an endorsement of the principle that Hamas is trying to implement by force on its own people? So I regard that as another example of a moral inversion. It's really sacrificial, and it confesses a profound inability to understand what animates Hamas, which is it's fundamentally an ideas-driven or nihilistic ideas-driven movement that is it's about destroying freedom, not creating it. And if your reaction is, let's find a way to appease the premise that they are acting on, I think you're on the wrong premise. I think you're defeating yourself if you do that. So I don't think it's a distraction from the actual goal that needs to be pursued.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to another topic. There are a lot of discussions about what to do once Hamas is defeated, or at least what to do once this conflict is somehow resolved. And one of the questions is who should govern Gaza and the West Bank? And well, one of the views that I hear most about, and it's also, I believe, the official view of the Biden administrations, is the so-called two-state solution. And I wonder, could you help us understand this two-state solution view, and how should we think about it? Is it a good goal, or if not, are there any other alternatives?
There are many alternatives, and the two-state solution is the farthest thing from a solution. It is what has brought us to this point. So the two-state solution has a long history, but the most recent version of it was put into practice in the early 1990s as part of a so-called peace agreement, the Oslo Accords. And the idea was that the Palestinians are owed a state of their own, and that they would be given one that would be the provisional state that become more and more sovereign over time. And that was going to have political responsibility over the West Bank territories and then also Gaza. What that led to is a dictatorship in the West Bank and Gaza and an authoritarian rule over the people, the Palestinian people in that area, by different Palestinian factions over time. So it became a new Middle East dictatorship that was militant and launched a terrorist war against Israel through the early 2000s. This was called the Second Intifada. In 2005-06, what happened is that Gaza broke off from the West Bank politically, and it became Hamas's regime. So then you get two Palestinian quasi-states. You get the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority, and you get Gaza under Hamas. And both of them are hostile to Israel. Hamas becomes the leader of this war against Israel, and it launches a series of rocket wars, and we've seen it escalate to the point of October 7th. So the idea of a two-state solution has been tried numerous times, and predictably it failed to bring any kind of peace. In fact, it made things far worse than it was before. It has led to this cataclysmic conflict with Hamas right now. So to me, it's a fantasy that anyone can seriously entertain this is a path forward. So that's the lesson of history. And this is something else I write about in What Justice Demands. The peace process, the two-state solution, has only made the conflict far, far worse over time. And if people are ignoring that, you have to ask, why are they ignoring that? What is it that they don't want to see? And I think part of the explanation, again, ties to this theme of how corrupting and perverting of one's ability to think morally is the idea of altruism. Now, it isn't the only influence on American policy, but it is a salient influence, and it's central to the whole idea of a two-state solution. And it's really important to emphasize how entrenched this view is. A lot of people will say, yes, the two-state solution is dead, it died long ago, and criticize the US for not pursuing it. That's one of the criticisms you hear a lot. But it is Biden wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post in November, reaffirming his view that this is the only path forward. It is a conventional view in the establishment in U.S. foreign policy. Richard Haass, who is I don't think you can get more establishment than him. He was the head of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was recently in an interview with Ezra Klein, and he said, the thrust of U.S. policy should have been and should be now preserve the option of a two-state solution. That's a paraphrase mostly. That is just sheer fantasy. And what animates it, I think, isn't just the ignoring of facts. It's a motivated ignoring of facts. It's an evasion. And what is the motive behind this evasion? It's the unwillingness to recognize that the Palestinian leadership, Palestinian movement, and then you can say something about the Palestinian people, but fundamentally Palestinian leadership for decades has been a fraudulent campaign to insist on their right to a state. And I say fraudulent because they have no basis for it in morality. They've proven that they're not interested in creating a better, freer society. They're interested in creating dictatorships. And dictatorship is not a solution to any real problem. You don't make people's lives better by enslaving them into dictatorships or theocracy. So it's not true that what they're after is a better way of living. And it's also fraudulent, or it's self-delusional on the part of the advocates of this in the West in this respect, which is it drops the context. It ignores the moral question of what would justify a state and what would people have to do to demonstrate that they are entitled to create a new society. Those questions are not seriously considered. It's taken as a given that the Palestinians are owed a state because they're long suffering, because they have misery, because they have not attained anything of significance, and because they're the world's certifiable victims and greatest sufferers, which is a position their leadership has cultivated. They're the world's most suffering people. That is seen as the passkey to the moral high ground. The sheer fact of their not having something, not achieving something, despite numerous opportunities to create a better society for themselves. That again is the influence of altruism. It's the elevation of those who have not achieved something, whose only claim to virtue is that they are sufferers, as opposed to having attained something and achieved something and pursued something and accomplished something. And what is so that's one dimension, that one aspect of what drives this view. The other is that it's the insistence that Israel's in the wrong for preventing this state, for the Palestinian state. And my view is that there are things Israel has done that probably make it harder to create a Palestinian state if you thought it was a good idea and it was justified. But I don't think that's the fundamental problem. I think Israel should fundamentally oppose the creation of a Palestinian state until or unless the Palestinians adopt better ideas. And that is the essential issue. They do not have ideas that would lead to a good society. In fact, we know what kind of societies their ideas lead to. The kind of societies that glorify murder, martyrdom, and the kind of slaughter that we saw on October 7th. If you ignore all that, if you evade all that and insist, continually insist that they have a right to a state, then you're not thinking about morality. It's a mockery of moral thinking. And you're certainly not thinking about justice. And you're not thinking about the well-being of any individuals, whether they're in Palestinian or under Palestinian control or under Israeli control. You're not really concerned with human life if you're dropping that moral context. So to me, it's sheer fantasy to pursue the two-state solution. It's not a solution. We know that. And it reflects this self-sacrificial, the insistence on self-sacrificial approaches on the grounds that you have to serve those who are suffering, regardless of why they're suffering and regardless of the opportunities they've forsaken in order to pursue better outcomes.
So I wanted to wrap up with a last question. Given what you've said about how the U.S., you think, is what is its conduct, its approach toward Israel, all the pressure, what do you think are the consequences of this approach for Israel, for the U.S., but also for the Middle East?
I'll say one thing in response. We should probably have another podcast about the consequences of where things are today. I'm really concerned that this is going to be a replay of previous rounds of conflict in which Hamas emerges maybe much weaker, but it still emerges and can regard this as it fought and survived the conflict. And even if it only survives, just the vestiges of it survive, that's still in their minds, and I think objectively, it's a victory. Because they've gone up against the United States, they've gone up against Israel as backed partly by the United States, and they've shown that they can inflict severe damage on Israel. They've shaken Israel's ability to protect itself. That was demonstrated October 7th. And that is a psychological blow, because Israel is so much more militarily strong, and this was demonstrating its vulnerability. And the fact that their cause is still achievable, they're still around. Like, that's the worry I have. That only the only thing that can be said is Hamas has been degraded, and if that's where we end up with this conflict, the predictable outcome, in my view, is that Israel will be held responsible for the suffering of Palestinians, for the fact that Gaza is a lot of it is rubble now. There isn't much to do in Gaza, and it will be held as the party that's most responsible for that suffering, despite the reality that it is Hamas's fundamental moral responsibility for all of the deaths and all of the destruction that has happened, precisely because it is the initiator of the war. So there's a corrupting influence in the way people think morally. And my view is it's going to shape the way the war's aftermath plays out. Now, I might be wrong, and I want to be wrong about what happens. I would like to see Hamas defeated. I think anyone who cares about freedom and individual rights and human progress should want to see Hamas stamped out of that area and defeated roundly, so that its vision, its corrupt nihilistic vision of a totalitarian Islamic society, that becomes something nobody wants to pursue. That's a good outcome, and I hope to see that. I don't think there's reason to expect it given the way things are going.
Okay, thank you, Letts. So I think we can wrap up here. We have some recommendations for you, apart from the two books that Ilan has mentioned, Winning the Unwinnable War, and especially What Justice Demands. We have one article on New Ideal, which is our sources, with a lot of links to our talks and articles and other episodes about this topic. Please make sure to join our next week show. And if you have, we will be releasing Q&A episodes where we will be answering your questions. So if you have any questions that you would like us to answer, please send those questions to experts@einrand.org. This is experts@einrand.org. And Ilan, thank you for today.
You've been listening to New Ideal, a podcast from the Ayn Rand Institute. If you like what you hear, leave us a review, share with a friend, and subscribe to our other podcasts. This podcast was made possible by donors to the Ayn Rand Institute. Help support this podcast by becoming an ARI member. Go to aynrand.org/membership.